Welcome to another episode of What If, where we consider how the present might be different if one tiny detail from the past were altered. In today's episode, it was Sunday, October 30th, 1938, and Orson Welles induced a panic with his radio drama based on the H.G. Wells classic novel, War of the Worlds. But what if one tiny detail were changed? What if instead of fiction, this had been a real Martian invasion? What would the Colin McEnroe show of today be like?
Welcome to another episode of the Colin McEnroe Show. Colin is still being held in a Martian prison, and my guest, as always, is a Martian official. The same Martian I've been interviewing every day for the past 9 years. You know, I still don't even know your name. Yeah, no, I know. I'm a stinking, wrecking Earth pig dog, and you can barely stand to look at me. And I have no purpose other than to serve my overlords from the great red planet. Today, I thought we might take a trip back in time. When you first came here in 1938, Earth people feared that you were here to destroy us. Right, but I don't think anyone guessed that your plan was to keep us alive and use suction cups to slowly drain the life force out of us. You say it's better than our unfair capitalist system, which produced winners and losers. This way everybody loses, except you guys. Was that laughing? Were you laughing at me, you sick? I don't think you can even comprehend the tedium of my life. The show is essentially the same every day. Why can't we have any other guests besides you? Why can't we consider some interesting topics? Well, we could do a show about, I don't know, what if instead of being a reproductive slave hooked up to a pitiless machine that maximizes the output of his gonads, Bill Buckner had played our old game of baseball? And what if, I don't know, life under Martian occupation has completely destroyed my capacity to dream or imagine? It's what we miss most, really. Our ability to dream about unrealized possibilities. That was our most precious asset. And most of us didn't even know it. Yeah, I know. I'm a putrid, rotting corpse plant, oozing fecal mucus. As if you hadn't said that a million times. Okay, I will. But first, I have to say the name of the man whose show this is. A man who, in a weak moment, attempted to collaborate and collude with you tentacled fascists, but now rots in one of your unnumbered cells. Yeah. Colin McEnroe.
All right, so that's what if. One tiny thing were different. If Orson Welles is a classic podcast rather than a podcast, a broadcast, had been real, you know, rather than being an adaptation. First of all, the other what if might be, what if everybody was named Welles because it was Orson Welles adapting H.G. Wells? My middle name is Welles. But that's not it. No, what if the Martians really had invaded? And it turns out what would happen, the worst thing that would happen would be that their pitiless occupation of our lives would deprive us of our ability to dream and imagine, which is really what this show today is about, dreaming and imagining. The focus of it is both a podcast and a book. Upon further review, the greatest what-ifs in sports history. And joining us right now, we'll have several guests along the way, including Will Leach, who's been with us many other times. But joining us right now, one of our favorite people, is the czar of what-ifery. I just gave him that title. And he, of course, is Mike Pesca, host of The Gist, master of many trades. But this, the book and the podcast, are his two latest projects. Mike Pesca, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thanks for having me. What-ifery, hypothetical-alism.
There you go. We need some nouns here.
I just have this thought of some very mean New York Post headline review. What-ifery whiffs.
Oh, no. They would never say that about you, though. Maybe the best way to get in here is to take an example from the book. And in some ways, the perfect example from the book is one that actually does require a little bit of explaining. It's the one about tug of war and the Olympics. And the first thing that we have to establish is the truth of that premise, right? Not everybody knows.
Right. So tug of war was an Olympic sport up until 1920. It was the United States was pretty good, of course. Lots of times there were six countries competing, and the United States always sent a team. So we won the second most medals in tug of war. We did, I say, about my forefathers before my actual forefathers might have even been in this country. But then it was dropped from the Olympics. And so I called Nate DiMeo, who does the Memory Palace podcast, because I'll tell you, I knew a secret about Nate. And I said, what if would you like, and before the ifery part of what ifery was out of my mouth, he said, tug of war in the Olympics. And I said, go, Nate, go. And the reason I knew he'd be good at this is because he wrote that book about Pawnee, the Parks and Rec book that was written from the voice of Leslie Knope. He actually wrote that. So he's excellent at constructing, you know, fake realities. Mm-hmm. And so he wrote his chapter as someone looking back at the history of tug of war. And, of course, post-1920, that history is entirely invented.
Right. And so, I mean, in a way, people, you're many contributors to this book, many of whom are very distinguished writers, and you're contributors to the podcast as well. They decided to interpret this assignment in different ways. But he's one of the ones who really did kind of what? He produced a document that could only exist in its form if, in fact, the fabric of sports history had been altered.
Yes. And this is great. There, in the beginning of the book, I lay out a few, I guess, rules or the structure that I imposed on the what if, because I always find that sports fans engage in what ifs, but they're really engaging in what abouts, you know, ruining the decision their team made. But one of the things I really wanted to embrace was the what if that leads to just fantastic and comic and thought-provoking ripples. So if there were tug of war, what would be the geopolitical implications? What sports figures might not have played their sport, but instead have gone into the tug? And then Nate takes it to places where I wouldn't even dare, because he figures that tug of war would be so popular that there were many movies based on tug of war, including Jesse and Glenn, where Jesse Owens and his team in the Hitler Olympics famously dropped the rope, thus embarrassing the Germans. And, of course, he has Crystal Gayle winning a Grammy for the love theme from Tug of Their Lives about that famous team. And he even lays out who wins the EGOT for just Tug of War materials. It's kind of an insane flight of fancy, shall we say.
So there is a kind of chaos theory in this and some of the other pieces, right? I mean, this winds up with O.J. Simpson as vice president of the United States somehow, right? Because once you change one thing, we all know from Star Trek, if you change one thing, all kinds of other things may change.
Yeah. And it's kind of weird because most of my chapters had O.J. Simpson becoming vice president. I had to cut it out of all the other ones. What if Wayne Gretzky hadn't been an Oiler? Somehow O.J. Simpson becomes vice president.
Really, it was O.J. Simpson's destiny to become vice president, and certain things apparently got in the way of that. I think that's...
We're living in that one reality where he didn't. It's so odd.
Everywhere else in the multiverse,
that's right.
He's a heartbeat away from the presidency, and which should make the president very nervous.
Right. And the book, If I Did It, was chair a commission on reconsidering appropriation. Yes.
So I have to ask, where was the germ of this idea? Where did it come from?
So I was, as you know, as you heard on this radio station, I was an NPR sports correspondent for 7 years. And I went to 7 Super Bowls and I think 6 World Series and many a Final Four, World Cup, etc. Always a winner, always a champion, mostly with confetti. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed going into the winners' locker rooms or clubhouse and having the sting of champagne in my eyes. But at some point, I said to myself those words. I said, what if, in thinking about my team, because you could see the Patriots win so often and you could see the San Francisco Giants win a couple of times, all these teams, UConn winning. And I'm a Mets fan and a Jets fan. And I could have been a Yankees fan and a Giants fan, but I happen to be a Mets fan and a Jets fan because that's how I was raised, and that's how, for some reason, I'm raising my sons. And I think I calculated, because of that, I've been denied 11 championships, and I really only got to experience one championship, which was the 86 Mets. So I did say, what if? But then I didn't want to revel in the, like I said, if only, and I began to think that the best way to collect stories of what ifs are to apply some rules. And what makes a good what-if sports story, in my estimation, were things like it needs to either settle a debate or the intellectual rigor needs to be very on point, or it needs to be a history lesson in the guise of a what if, or it just needs to be flat out funny. And we have examples of all of those in the 31 essays and a couple examples in the Malcolm Gladwell intro.
Right. And so I think we have to make that point that for somebody who is not familiar with this, it might seem as simple as, and by the way, every sports fan, I think, has some kind of fantasy. As a Packers fan, I have this idea that I'm going to go back in time somehow or other and get them to not draft Tony Mandarich, you know, who's this steroidally pumped up, artificially inflated, very, very high draft choice on the offensive line when they could have had Derek Thomas or Barry Sanders. I'm going to fix this somehow. I'm going to show up in the general manager's office and explain this to them, and they're going to do the right thing, and life is going to be so much better. Like, every sports fan has some version of that, but right. These essays are not entirely like that, and in many instances, in the final segment of today's show, we're going to highlight one in particular, where the essay really is intended not to show how things could have been, but how things are.
Yes, and for the most part, when I bring this up to people who are excited, who are sports fans, their eyes will light up, and they'll usually say something like, what if Michael Jordan were taken first by the Portland Trail Blazers? And I will say that is a totally legitimate thing to think about as a sports fan, but I couldn't escape the answer of, well, then the Portland Trail Blazers would have been great because they had Michael Jordan. Right. And they were pretty good without Michael Jordan, with, you know, having blown their pick essentially on Sam Bowie, but with Michael Jordan, of course they would have been good. Where is the chapter? You just could superimpose or Photoshop a Blazers jersey on Jordan. That's a cute visual. But, you know, where does it go from there? Where are the ripples? So almost all of the chapters are not about that one missed play, but they're more about, I don't know, society or humor or history. So we have a blimp full of money exploding over World Track headquarters by Paul Snyder, and that's an exercise in somehow let's have a conceit where we put track and field at the center of American sport because it could have happened and how things would be different. Or we have a faux memoir by Stefan Fatsis, what if Bucky Dent hadn't homered over the Green Monster in 78? And so the short answer is, well, the Red Sox win then. But it's his execution and his idea of what the ripples would be. For instance, Good Will Hunting is not about an MIT math guy. It's about a guy who works at the Hunts Point Market in the Bronx.
So there's a whole category of literature. We did an entire show about it a while ago called speculative fiction, which turns out to be, you know, basically 400 novels and short stories about what would happen if the other side had won World War II, 85 books and short stories about what would happen if the Civil War had come out differently, and like four other things. I don't know what the other four things are about.
What if the Canadians had succeeded in burning down the White House in 1812?
Right, something like that. So and that's a different thing. You know, there's a way in which sports kind of screams out for this kind of tinkering and dabbling, but what is it about sports that makes it, is it just that it's kind of a safe place to experiment?
It is, yeah. It's a petri dish. It's a place for experimentation. I thrilled to the fact that we could do some experimenting that would reverberate beyond sports. But at the very least, it is an exercise in pointing out that even though history did happen that way, that doesn't mean it was inevitable. And my chapter, or my introduction, starts with George Washington and the Battle of Brooklyn and escaping because of the fog. And I read up a lot about it, and it's not just a rhetorical point to make. Most historians do agree that if not for the atmosphere, if not for the fog at the time, the colonials would have been decimated and history might have been entirely different. So I wanted to make the point that just because history unfolded that way doesn't mean that it definitely would have. But then, in a lot of the essays, I also wanted to have the sort of essay where what if something drastically different had happened, that the actual world events wind up asserting themselves. So in our What If Billie Jean King Had Lost to Bobby Riggs essay, I don't want to give too much away, but the author, Wayne Coffey, asserts, guess what, she would have come back to win because there was no keeping Billie Jean King down. And it's well reported and it's a history lesson. But I think that that is an apt conclusion. So just because history isn't inevitable doesn't mean that everything, one ripple would have changed everything. And I think about the election and I think about the word overdetermined. And I think about, we like to play what-ifs with either Comey or visiting the upper Midwest, or I just had James Clapper on the show, Russian interference, and everyone said, you change one of those variables, you change the whole election. Yes, but I don't know. I don't know if that's necessarily true. It seems to be that, you know, there are many instances in history which happened because, not that they were preordained, but there were real strong reasons for them to happen.
We're talking to Mike Pesca, the book and the podcast. It's a book and a podcast and a breath mint. It's called Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History. Listening to the podcast, I find myself thinking that I need to write a what-if essay called What If Robert Siegel Really Retired? Because Robert Siegel is everywhere. He's hosting On Point today, and he's doing your podcast. He narrates a pretty terrific one, speaking of Brooklyn. It's the story of what would happen if the Brooklyn Dodgers had not migrated to the West Coast.
Right.
And once again, it, like a lot of other sort of centers of gravity, then tip because of that.
You always wanted to hear Robert Siegel quote Biggie Smalls, and this is the chance to do it. I say that he spent 30, maybe 40 years building up his credibility, and then in one fell swoop, he sullies it by engaging in this act of fiction and chicanery. And in fact, it was so good that Mayor de Blasio either heard it or read a write-up of it and said, NPR has come out with this new podcast. I'm like, no, it's only in the style of NPR. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I guess it worked.
So it's, of course, June. It's the time when really always people are talking about football. Now, that doesn't seem right, but we are talking about football. Obviously, the White House has decided that we will. And there are a number of football essays here, including one written by a football player, Nate Jackson. Tell us about that essay.
That's a little different from all the other essays in the book, because most of the essays looked at something that happened and changed it. And in a way, this does, but that essay is What If Football Were Invented Today. It has echoes of a Jason Gay essay, which is What If Football Were Deemed Too Boring in 1899. But Jason Gay just sort of wishes football out of existence and chronicles the deep impact on the foam finger industry without any football. What Nate does is he says we know what we know about brain injuries, but we also know what we know about exciting athleticism. And look at the athletes in basketball and look at these multidimensional players like Tatum or Giannis or Porzingis, these Swiss Army knife players. There are fantastic athletes in football. Why is it that it's so structured and, you know, there's an offensive lineman is not a quarterback, is not a wide receiver? So he kind of tinkers with football. He keeps four downs, and he keeps 6 points for a touchdown, and he keeps the timing and the quarters and 100 yards and all that. But what he really attacks is the idea of the pocket, and he thinks that creating this these five obese men who protect this one relatively unathletic man, I mean, not that Tom Brady or Peyton Manning aren't an athlete, but compared to everyone else on the field, they are the worst athlete. And he says, let's reinvent football as more of an open sport with less head injuries, with less punting, with less stop and start, so therefore fewer grievous injuries, with less obesity. A little bit of a cliche, but I do think it's a fine thought exercise.
I should say the collection Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History, compiled, edited, curated by Mike Pesca, a host of Slate podcast The Gist. My two submissions, what if the first major star of Ultimate Frisbee had been Oddjob from the James Bond movies, and what if Bill Raftery were a woman? They were not accepted. They were not even acknowledged as submissions. I'm a little troubled by that.
Okay, if Bill Raftery were a woman, his catchphrase would not be onions, it would be omelet.
Well, that's what I was thinking. You know, can I just say that about I've wanted to say this for a while. You know, here in 2018, and we've got the Me Too movement, and we've got all kinds of things like this, and change sensibilities. I think it's time for Bill Raftery to stop talking about the onions of young men who play college basketball. I mean, their onions are really none of his business.
He is. I love Bill Raftery, and we all love Bill Raftery. But maybe you're right. Maybe you're right. Maybe we just have to assign him some NBA games and his WNBA games, and his creativity will peek through.
Right. I just, it's, you know, that particular expression had its time. It was, there was an appropriate moment for it. So one of America's most distinguished and beloved sports writers is Jesse Eisenberg. But he is in this book. And he, the actor Jesse Eisenberg, I happened to, for very weird reasons, like the Phoenix Suns. So I was quite excited to see that there was going to be something that would redirect the destiny of the Phoenix Suns, besides the fact that they'll probably draft DeAndre Ayton in a few weeks. But I didn't really get what I wanted, but it was very funny. Maybe you want to just sort of tease the Eisenberg thing a little bit without wrecking it too much.
Yeah, well, one tease is the cover of the book, which has Charles Barkley in a Suns uniform holding the NBA, the Larry O'Brien trophy. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, we debated who would be the best person to hold, to Photoshop into either the Larry O'Brien trophy or the Vince Lombardi trophy. And it was either Dan Marino holding the NFL trophy, which he never did, or Patrick Ewing or Charles Barkley holding the O'Brien. And we said it had to be Barkley just because I guess there was a very similar shot of him holding the MVP for the All-Star game. That said, Jesse does an essay where he remembers himself as a 12-year-old having written a fan letter to Dan Marley, because he idolized Dan Marley, and what 12-year-old wouldn't at the time?
And for NPR people. Listeners, we have to say that Dan Marley was, you know, sort of a above-average white Phoenix Suns basketball player who played very hard-nosed defense and averaged about 13.9 points a game. I don't know. Somehow or other, we have to put Dan Marley in the minds of people for whom he may remain an abstraction.
I sometimes forget that not everyone knows Dan Marley, just like not everyone knew in Something About Mary that Brett Favre's name was not pronounced Favre.
Right.
The layman might say Dan Majerly, who is this guy? But he is Dan Marley. Jesse writes him a letter, and he feels that the letter changed history, distracted the Phoenix Suns in their locker room as they prepared for their finals showdown with the Chicago Bulls. And then it, of course, changed Jesse himself. And the upshot, I thought the upshot of all this was how Jesse reckons with it on the page and in the podcast. And the podcast was produced by Jonathan Mitchell, who does a podcast called The Truth, which is excellent. He's a virtuoso. He's fantastic. He took Jesse's words from the page, turned it into a script. We had actors act out the parts. And then the greatest thing happened. This podcast comes to the attention of the real Dan Marley. He absolves Jesse of his guilt, and on a Phoenix radio station, Jesse Eisenberg and Dan Marley have a summit where all is forgiven and they agree to meet someday.
Right. There's a lot of that that goes on anyway. We have to take a break here because Will Leach is ready to join us. But, I mean, last night at Fenway Park, well before the crowd showed up, I believe, Kirk Gibson and Dennis Eckersley sat side by side in the stands having a protracted conversation about one of the most famous home runs in history, which Gibson was obviously eager to talk about and Eckersley was surprisingly willing to talk about. But that kind of thing, I mean, athletes kind of like that stuff, I think. I mean, these certain kinds of athletes.
Yes. Although I will say the Marley-Eisenberg meeting had far less facial hair than the one you're describing.
All right. So we're going to take a break. We're going to bring on Will Leach, and we're going to talk more about What If.
What if things had changed?
I mean, I'm a positive person, but I don't really know.
What if things were different?
And we're back. I still haven't really mastered that picking up the cue thing. You know, it's too dark in the room where you're holding your fingers up. I can't even see them. All right. So joining us now, well, we have Mike Pesca, host of Slate's daily podcast, The Gist, and the author, curator, compiler, everything of Upon Further Review, The Greatest What Ifs in Sports History. Joining us is one of the contributors to said book and podcast, Will Leach, a national correspondent for Major League Baseball, contributing editor at New York Magazine, and the host of Sports Illustrated's The Will Leach Show. His piece, Upon Further Review, is What If Baseball Teams Only Played Once a Week. Will's been with us lots of other times, but Pesca and Leach at the same time, we're really approaching some kind of singularity here of I don't know what exactly. I don't know what might happen, but the gravity might really, really contract. So get ready. Will, welcome back to our airwaves and say hello to your friend Mike.
that it is an honor. I'd like to take this opportunity to haggle with Mike over some rights issues. I think we should. This is probably the right time to do it.
Right.
Well, just give us a second. Okay, fine. We'll talk about the book.
Right. Yeah. I think you're getting 10% of the plush toys. So
I'm just asking myself, what if he were kidding?
So, Will, I would count your essay as one of the essays that, although it explores things being different, it's really a commentary on how things are. You speculate that, you know, maybe there's really too much baseball, that the problem with baseball is that it just happens all the time during its season.
Yeah, I don't know if I would argue that it's necessarily a problem as much as, you know, one of the things that's very frustrating for me as someone that is baseball first is when people make the arguments of like, oh, well, football is our greatest sport because look at the television ratings. And I've always noted that, well, one of the reasons the baseball ratings are not so high is because baseball is not meant to be an event. Football, by definition, is built to be event programming. In baseball, it's like a river, you know. Like you can go swim in it if you want. You can swim in it all day, or you can look at it from a bridge of afar. You can drive by it without ever even thinking about it, but it's always happening. And to me, that's one of the things I love about baseball. But it is frustrating for me when people will try to use what I would argue are kind of shaky math arguments on, well, television ratings for football are so much better. Well, yeah, the reason is because football is played once a week. So I thought, what if at the beginning, when baseball had started, baseball was actually just a once-a-week game? Because obviously I think it would make the ratings go up because it would be more event-based. But how would it change the way the sport was played? So I thought that would be kind of a fun way to make Mr. Pesca deal with my dramatic grammatical mistakes and all of my horrible vulgarities in the book project.
So, Mike, reading Will's piece, one thing that I mean, I'm a big baseball fan and I enjoy the baseball season, but I became aware of the fact that, yeah, you know, rather than being a game, as he suggests, it's kind of a context. And it's also, because of the way that it's played, because of the 162-game schedule plus postseason, it's like Coronation Street, like one of those British soap operas that's been on the air for 175 years that, you know, you really can't just jump in that easily. There's a way in which if you want to tell some young friend of yours, hey, watch this.
Yeah.
You know, anyway, yeah, I'd be interested in your thoughts.
Well, first of all, I think the Coronation Street analogy is good. And if I knew anything about Coronation Street, I would make an analogy or pivot off that to the balk rule or the infield fly rule, because I'm sure there is some similarity. The river idea is also good. Now, what I did was I asked Will Leach, all right, take that river and redirect it. And we see how well that has gone in the Mississippi over the years when man intervenes. So Will, and by the way, if you want to talk about errors that were made again and again and again, I think I spelled Leach three different ways in my original draft of the book. But Will writes about baseball and takes this conceit, and it really does. What is baseball? If I said, you know, define baseball and I'll give you 500 words, you probably wouldn't write about the everyday nature. But if you change the everyday nature, you change baseball so much. You change what baseball means and how the positions are filled and the place it has in our imagination to such a degree, it's almost unimaginable.
But it is imaginable, and Will imagined it. And so Will, what are the things, yeah, to Mike's point, you imagine that each team would have a starting pitcher, and then two lefties in the bullpen, two righties in the bullpen, and a closer, so that every time the Red Sox played, it would be Chris Sale versus CC Sabathia, or whoever those two, or maybe because of somebody else's essay, O.J. Simpson would be a pitcher now. I don't know. I've really lost track. But Will, you talk a little bit more about how you think the game would shape itself differently around this idea.
Yeah, I feel like that's kind of the primary way, right? It would basically turn the starting pitcher, into the quarterback. Like, certainly every time you see in a NFL game broadcast, it's always Tom Brady against Aaron Rodgers, Patriots versus Packers. But it's very rare you see that in. And basically, if you had the starting pitcher to do that, they'd become that person. They would become the most important part of every single game and the single selling point of that entire team. And so I think what it would do is obviously it would make rosters smaller because you wouldn't need all those players. I also think it would increase the importance of sluggers because one run now means so much more. The same way that, you know, if someone can go through a slump and they, and you can bench them here, but like in it was just one game, because the idea is that you don't just play it weekly, but you actually average, I think, came out to 18 games to what the NFL season would be. So all of a sudden, one game, whereas Major League Baseball now it's only one 162nd of a season. But if this were 1/16 of a game like the NFL, every game would be based. You'd want that home run here. You would home runs would be of a much more important aspect because they're so hard to get. You're facing the best pitcher every time. That would be a larger issue of it. I also looked at not just the gameplay aspect, but the way the game would be promoted and the way the game would, I think, would be televised. Because I think that is the argument that people always make for the NFL. It's such a big event. We all come around. We all come out and tailgate all day and watch the game. Whereas baseball, guys, there's like 7 baseball games going on this exact second, and no one has noticed. That's what baseball is. Baseball is always happening in that way. So if you switch baseball into an event-based thing, it not only morphs the sport, it morphs how we even talk about the sport. Every game becomes this thunderous life and death thing. I feel like, I wonder if the game would become more inherently physical and maybe even more violent because they have 6 days to recover. It's not the grind the way the baseball is now. So it certainly, it's just strange to think that a sport is supposed to be self-contained. It's supposed to be its own thing. But simply by changing how often you play it, you change the game pretty dramatically.
See, Mike, I think your next spinoff here is going to be sort of a Mike and the Mad Dog type call-in sports talk show where people call up and argue over, like, Will's premise and say, no, Giancarlo Stanton, he wouldn't be worth as much because he strikes out too much, you know.
And then somehow we decide who's right and wrong. But what Will is saying, think about it now. Think about, he made the comparison to football. Think about if football were like baseball, and it's, instead of a quarterback, if there were a rotation. I mean, in baseball, there are guys, pitchers with an ERA in the high fours who aren't very good. But, you know, you only have to be one of the 120 best starting pitchers to be guaranteed a job. But with football, if you're the 38th best quarterback, or in the case of Colin Kaepernick, better than that, if you're the 48th best quarterback, you really don't have a job. So how we're defining the person who has the ball and does most of the action and who we're giving that responsibility to is totally different in the two sports, and totally because of how often the sports are played.
I think, Will, one of the observations that you made that I hadn't thought that much about is that baseball is in many ways the most physically demanding professional sport, not because it has the kinds of collisions or you know, high-speed sprints and stuff like that that you might see in football or basketball, but because it goes on for so long, because there's no relief.
Yeah, particularly now. You know, I mean, I think the days, I think it's worth noting that when you talk to old players in the 70s and talk to them about steroids, they say, oh, we would never use PEDs. We would never PEDs. Oh, but greenies? Oh, yeah, we needed those things. We play every day. There's like an afternoon game after a night game. And I think, you know, that is, I think, pretty telling about just to get up every single day and to perform like that. I think there's this idea people have that, like, well, baseball, they just work 3 hours of the day, a day. Yeah, if only. Like, the idea that the only time they're performing or the only time they're getting paid and doing their job during the 3 hours, I think that's clearly not the case. And you add in travel to that idea. Think about how different travel is in an idea where there's a weekly game. You only have one travel a week. Now you see teams going back and forth. You saw this fight the Yankees are having with ESPN is basically about this idea of a long travel after a night game for a day game. And I think that is the travel, the grind. Barry Cerulla for the Washington Post, who's the beat reporter for the Nationals, wrote a terrific book last year called The Grind, and it really is about the idea where he interviews everybody involved in baseball, from the players to the clubhouse attendants to the wives of the players, and just how much it takes out of you. Not so much at the end of every game you're like, whew, I ran so hard that game, I need a Gatorade or something. You shouldn't drink Gatorade, just drink water. But certainly that kind of thing, it's not that kind of tired, it's the fact that you have to do it every day for 6 months out of the year and add travel. It just is a lot on these players. And I think you see with how rosters are constructed, you have to have 40-man rosters for a 25-man team, and they're constantly going up and down for the minors. That's all because they play every single day and how much it takes out of people.
You know, obviously, Will, this book has really taken off. I think there's a copy in virtually every American home at this point. And I'm wondering, first of all, whether you do need to renegotiate your cut of it. But also, I'm also wondering, sports fans are kind of notoriously bad at distinguishing a fanciful concept from a serious concept. Have you run into people already who are almost enraged that you would entertain such an idea as cutting the season down to 26 games from 162?
Well, yeah, one of the people that is enraged by this idea is me. I would hate it if a baseball were like this. This, I actually end the essay, spoiler alert, but I actually end the essay with the idea like, wow, this would be absolutely terrible and represent everything I didn't like about baseball, which is actually kind of the point, right? As someone that defends baseball against football, I would argue a lot of football's inherent advantages in the American marketplace are not because it's a better game or a more fair game, certainly not because it's a safer game, but just because the way that we kind of artificially inflate events and spectacle happens to benefit this game that I would argue is inferior, that is an inferior game to this game that we actually play all the time. There's an old joke about the idea that if you give someone something for free, they will not value it, but if they charge $50 for it, they will realize how much important it is to them. Baseball happens all the time, and because of that, you get used to it and you don't value it as much. I would argue that it would be kind of ironic that taking away hundreds of baseball games a week would actually make people appreciate baseball more, I think, in the short term. But I like watching baseball games, so I wouldn't want to have this happen at all.
Yeah, Mike, as I was reading Will's piece, I was sort of thinking, yeah, it's sort of why you can't really kind of do da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da tonight, 162nd of something that provides a lot of context to people's lives for the warmer months of the year.
Yeah, I wanted to note that Will, who loves the pace of baseball, I assigned him the baseball essay, and he concludes it by saying, I'm glad it's not like what I portray. And Paul, who wrote my blimp full of money and the world track essay, says, I kind of like track being this little obscure thought. But one of the great joys of this was so I would talk to my competitors, hello, I would talk to my contributors, I mean, I've got sports on the mind, and some alchemy would occur. And as Will was saying this, I just had this idea, this theory. So baseball was America's game in the 70s and 80s, and now football's America's game. Yeah, our drug of choice in the 70s and 80s was a stimulant, right? That was like greenies in baseball and cocaine in the 80s. Now our drug of choice as a nation is an opiate, which is a painkiller, which is analogous to the drug of choice in the NFL. I don't know. If sports is a drug or a distraction for the masses, it strikes me as notable that the sports we like somehow mirror the drugs we like as a country.
Well, Will Leach, it was just a dream you had, okay? Mm-hmm. Everything's okay. Go back to sleep. There's still 162 games of the season. Giancarlo Stanton is not an oral surgeon. He is still a baseball player. Everything's just great. But, Will, thanks for being with us.
Yes, Bobby Ewing is in the shower over here, so everything is totally fine. Thanks for having me.
All right. Actually, it's not fine if Bobby Ewing is in your shower. We have to take a break. Come back after this.
What if dolphins took over public radio? The credits would sound like this. Amanda Fish would get eaten. The part of Bill Curry would be played by... Really? Him? I've seen his work, and I doubt he has the dramatic range. Also, terrible herring breath. And now...
That's how they say my name. I hate it. I hate the way they say my name. All right. Our final conversation today is going to be about, I think, maybe my favorite essay in this book. And before we even introduce the guest and writer who goes along with it, I'm going to sort of remind you of what things were like in 1999.
So these players played a full 90, most of them, then another 30. So you're looking at 120 minutes in intense heat and pressure. And now, the biggest pressure of their lives, for most of these women, maybe all, their most important penalty kicks ever.
As Brandi Chastain strode to the penalty box, it was as if the whole country was holding its breath.
I'm not sure of the word, but it was just such a heavy moment.
Look at the face.
And the feeling was, I think, you know, the future of women's soccer depends on the outcome of this game.
Chastain will take it.
Chastain set down the ball.
And as I put the ball down and I looked up, there was the goalkeeper standing in front of me. And kind of like two boxers in the middle of the ring, she literally psyched me out. She totally gave me like a smile and a wink. And I was like, that's the weirdest thing that's ever happened.
Then she started her run.
And even though I hit the ball well, it hit the crossbar and went out.
China made their next kick and then eventually pulled ahead in points. Suddenly, the game was over. The crowd sat stunned in their seats.
Yeah, you want to know what it sounded like?
Yeah.
You ready?
Yep.
Listen. That's what it sounded like. It's amazing how quiet 90,000 plus people could be.
Okay, that obviously is not how things were in 1999. That is our guest, Louisa Thomas, a NewYorker.com contributor, a former writer and editor for Grantland, and the author of Louisa, The Extraordinary Life of Mrs. Adams. She wrote a piece in Upon Further Review with Mike Pesca. She didn't write it with Mike Pesca, but Mike Pesca is here with us right now, is what I'm trying to convey, called What If the 1999 U.S. Women's National Soccer Team Had Lost the Women's World Cup? You're just hearing a clip from the fourth episode of the Upon Further Review podcast, where Louisa and the actual Brandi Chastain play out this idea. First of all, Louisa Thomas, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to say, for people who don't like spoilers, it's hard to do spoilers in a what if, a speculative nonfiction thing, but this piece is different from the others in the sense that it has what you might call a turn, and I don't know how we could possibly discuss it without kind of referring a little bit to that turn, so I don't know what you do with that information, but I just don't want you screaming at me later that I wrecked it for you. First of all, I guess the first question I want to ask Louisa is, you or somebody recruited Brandi Chastain to play out this scenario in the opposite way from how it happened. How open was she to that idea?
Well, actually, we did a little fudging. If you listen to the rest of the podcast, we actually reveal that she was talking about a different moment.
And we
replay that, you know, replay that moment. She was actually talking about she had missed a penalty kick against the Chinese goalkeeper in a previous tournament in the run-up to the World Cup.
So
she was describing that moment.
So we all remember the real moment, and she drops to her knees, and as you write in your piece, and she, as she's seen male soccer players do, tears off her top jersey and raises her arms high in her sports bra, and it becomes, I hadn't known this until I read your piece, but it's presence among iconic sports photographs. This is what? I mean, give us kind of a sense of how big an image this really is.
I believe that Sports Illustrated conducted some kind of poll about, you know, its most famous iconic covers, and this came in second after the Miracle on Ice photo. So that's pretty high up there.
Right. I just want to say, first of all, this whole moment changed my life in a way, because about a year later, I was in a pickup soccer game, mainly with a bunch of kids, and I was trying to illustrate my mastery of the Mia Hamm cutback. And you know how when you're doing that, Mike, you yell out the name of the person that you're printing, you're like, you know, LeBron James, you know, as you do this thing. So I yelled Mia Hamm as I did this cutback, and I completely severed the tendon which connects my quadriceps to my kneecap.
Ooh, that's a bad one.
Yeah, it's a really bad one.
That is because you mocked the goddess.
Right.
She was offended.
Right, yes. I aspired to be so much more than I really was, little worm that I actually was in life. So anyway, I want to say that 1999 changed a lot of things for me. But, Louisa, your piece is terrific. And first of all, you talk about, first, what would be different if the Chastain goal hadn't happened. So I'll just drop a few of those on us. Go ahead. Just mention a few of the things that would be different.
Well, you know, there would be professional soccer leagues that failed. The amount of coverage of women's sports, which had seemed to be kind of right on the cusp of becoming a real kind of mainstay in daily life, would have fallen off. Women would be covered in less exciting ways than men's sports. And there would be a kind of ongoing struggle for respect and equality in the larger public consciousness.
Right. So this is the so-called turn in your piece, right? That, is, in fact, is the way things are, that the kind of dramatic
yep.
changes, the dramatic changes that might have been expected to attend something as watched and iconographically idolized as this incredible moment ultimately didn't seem to have the kind of world-changing effect. Can you talk a little bit more about that, Louisa, about sort of how you process that?
Sure. I mean, when I began this essay, I didn't expect that this is the way it was going to go. In my head, when I said that I would do this, I sort of imagined what I think most people imagine, which is that I was going to, do some research and realize that it was this kind of huge turning point in the history of women's sports, because I think that's how we generally talk about it. But the more I read and the more I thought about it, the more I realized that progress is slow and halting, and the dynamic is not, things don't always seem to be getting better in the way that we expect that they should and did. But at the same time, I don't think that that means that it didn't have an impact. I didn't mean to say that at all. But it wasn't, quite the huge, flipping point that I think I had expected going into this project.
Right. I tried to write my own version of this particular essay 4 or 5 times, and it just kept ending with Michelle Akers and I said settling down together. I couldn't really get much further than that in my own imagination. But I do want to say, Louisa, that in a way, I sit right now in kind of a third part of the multiverse where, in fact, things are different. It's a magical land called Connecticut.
It's called UConn.
I mean, here everything is as one might have hoped. I mean, women's
yes.
sports are talked about absolutely on a par, if not one rung above, men's sports, and are talked about with great animation. It's just the other 49 states, right?
It's funny because, whenever you write something, you're always worried that you're sort of overstating the case. Maybe like actually things are totally great. And then we posted a link to this podcast and tons of these comments have been like, oh, women's sports sucks. Who cares? And you're like, well, okay.
there is a way in which things can be better. I don't know, Mike, how does the piece sit for you within this collection? It really is kind of the one, it really does have this terrific little surprise turn in it, right?
Yeah. Well, especially since the original conceit was, what if when Brandi Chastain ripped off her shirt, she had a Ben Affleck-like back tattoo? that wouldn't have been as good. It's fantastic, and working with Louisa was fantastic, and getting her to do episode 4 of the Upon Further Review podcast was so good. And to illustrate that, we worked on the piece, the print piece, and then we worked on the podcast, and then I listened to the podcast, and I said I have to do sort of a post-podcast Q&A with Louisa just about this idea of progress. And in our Q&A, I essentially asked, is it bad if we have this idea that that was the moment when everything changed, when that is not how history worked? What are the consequences of holding on to a myth of the tipping point moment from which we never go back from? And since Louisa is a historian as well as a sports writer, she gave some great insight and context as to that.
Well, we have to stop there. But first of all, we have barely scratched the surface of this book and the podcast series, too. Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History by Mike Pesca. So great also to have Louisa Thomas here with us for the final segment. Since the Dolphins didn't really do a very good job, I'm not talking about Dan Marino anymore, but the actual Dolphins, I should say that Jonathan McPants is the person who produced this podcast, and Kyone Wolf has been on the board today, and lots of other people, I'm sure, have helped us as well. Thanks very much for listening. We'll be back tomorrow.